council, who are based right across the road in the same on what the HSRC is. We are a statutory organisation established by an Act of Parliament. And in fact, there's a new Act which is sitting in the Presidency at the moment waiting to be signed. The last HSRC Act is dated 68. So there's a 2008 HSRC Act which is about to be signed into law. And we're basically there to provide a social science research for the people of South Africa. And we report through DST, Science and Technology. We're effectively a science council. We get about half of our money from Parliament, from you, in what's called the baseline grant. So it's an amount of money, it's about 100 million rand from Parliament. And we use that to fund about 12 or 13 different programs, looking at everything from HIA, land issues. My particular unit is called Democracy and Governance, so we look at all sorts of issues to do with electoral systems and anything to do with consolidating our democracy. We also do quite a lot of work looking into Africa to see how we can but in fact, the HSRC is a statutory organization which reports to Parliament in effect if we are with you. I'm going to carry on. It's just sort of pictures and a few notes, really. So I can give you copies of the presentation as we go along. Okay. Just a quick idea about this particular research, which is on xenophobia and particularly on the violence, and about where we are with that and how it comes about. This presentation isn't long, by the way. It's about 20 minutes, and I'm comfortable if you want to ask questions as we go along. Then just indicate that we'll do the things immediately, or we can do it at the end chair. I wanted to say thanks to the chair, actually, for inviting me to come. We were always very anxious and keen to come to Parliament to present our research and to engage with you. We've done so at quite a few different committees. But we were here yesterday with Science and Technology, so thanks for the invitation. And I must say at the outset that this research, we're not housing experts. You know, we're social scientists, and we came at this angle, this research from a different angle, and housing just kept coming up over and over and over again. So that's partly why I'm here. I'm afraid this presentation might raise more questions than provide answers for you as people specializing in housing policy. Where we are okay, so first of all, I'm going to give a brief overview of the research, then I'm going to talk about housing as a factor in the xenophobic violence, related issues, recommendations, and the way forward. That's the general presentation. It's about 13 slides, which will take about 10 minutes. Okay, the process to date. In May this year, you'll remember, the violence suddenly broke out. It started in Alex. It spread to many townships across the country, mainly to informal settlement areas. 50 people dead, tens of thousands of people displaced. You remember how what a shock it was to everybody when that happened. We, as the HSRC, we usually do our research over longer periods, over a year or over 2 years, like universities. You know, we look at all the books and we look at the policy and we travel around and we conduct surveys and we do all that. And 2 years later, we come out with a report, and by then, people have forgotten what the original incident was about. We're trying to be more proactive now, to respond quickly. We're in the middle of, in my unit, setting up what we're calling a rapid response research team, where we can go in and do stuff as quickly as possible to find out what's going on. That's what we did for this. Within 3 days, we had a field team in Tembisa, in Alex, in Mamelodi. A couple of days after that, in Nimizamo-Yetu here in Cape Town. And our main objective was to pull people together to say, what's happening? What's going on? What's causing this violence? Why are people so angry? What are the causes in your areas? What's the situation? And we did that. We broke the focus groups up into gender. We had men and women, and also by age. So we had different ages. Because obviously things affect different groups particularly. And one of the things that we came across, in fact, was that gender is a very important issue in the Bible. Because if you think, we could talk about this a bit later. But often when migrants come into the country looking for work, they do so, they're young men, they don't usually bring their families, they do often bring skills and experience. They arrive in informal settlement areas, which is the first place they look for to find housing. And who do they start competing for resources with? They start competing with young South Africans. So immediately we've got a gendered contest that starts to take place. And that lies at the root of much of the conflict that we have. Okay, so within a couple of days we were in the field, we were talking to people with these focus groups, and I'll show you some of the comments that came out of that just now. We then put together, with all the data, and we put together a report, which is the first HSRC report that we did. It came out within 2 weeks of the violence taking place. We gave it to Mr. Kwee, and he handed it to Cabinet. So within two and a half weeks, we had a report finished, printed, and already in the hands of Cabinet. And what that report was, we called it perception, what people think about what happened. And people aren't always right about what happened. But that was at least what they were thinking. And it was the first step to understanding what was going on in our country. The follow-up process from that was that we then called together a workshop of stakeholders, 50 stakeholders representing government, representing civil society, faith groups, NGOs, universities, and we brought them all together in Pretoria in our head office. Around a table in an event that was supported and funded by the British High Commission, who had their own experience with xenophobia, but that's a different story. So we started to look at this first report and look at people's perception and say, is this true? Is this really what happened? What are the explanations? How does that fit in with international experience? What do we learn from this? So we know the first report was done very quickly and was a perception-driven issue in the heat of the violence. Second one, which is the one that many of you have copied of, is the outcome of the round table. So now this is a much more considered look at the data. The first article that appears in this, or chapter in this book, summarizes the first report and was written by my colleague over there, Seren Pillay, who will be happy to engage through you with the committee if there are any questions about that. We probably have to have many takes about some of the questions. And the rest of this is the thoughts that came out of that round table, but also recommendations around what we should do, and a discussion of the causes of the violence. So this came out, was launched in Alex, where the violence first kicked off, about 2 weeks ago. So it's very current, and I think I'm here because the chair heard some of the media reportage about that launch. And as I said earlier, housing just kept coming up, and that's why I had to speak to you guys. Okay. So that still brings us up to roughly where we are. There have been a number of government processes or other processes that have been taking place, not just the HSRC that's looking at this. The Department of Home Affairs had a big embezzle on the xenophobia. Parliament itself had planned something which was then postponed. Quite a few of the government departments, including the Presidency and Home Affairs, were present at our round table. And there have also been quite a few academic conferences and discussions. I think, in fact, there's a conference on today at UCT, which is on religion and xenophobia. So everyone's talking about this issue from a lot of different angles. We don't claim to be the sole authority chair on this particular issue, but we're, I think, part of the process of trying to understand what happened and trying to prevent it from happening again. Right. Okay, still haven't got anything up on the screen. Was housing a factor in the violence? is the title at the top of the slide. And I've just got a few quotes, so if you don't mind, they're not long, I just want to read them out to you. They're taken from the focus group that we did in Alex, Tembisa, and Namalodi. I actually went through all the transcripts of the focus group yesterday, and I did a search on housing. And I really had to work hard to narrow it down. Housing came up in those discussions. Remember, this is about 2 days after the violence. Over and over and over again. Virtually everybody had something to say about the fact that the importance of housing in conflict in communities and as a trigger for the virus. So just a few quotes. This is one from this is from a young male, Alexander. This is a quote. I haven't edited it. The people of Alexandra are worried about the issue of the houses because the Department of Housing is corrupt. There are people who obtained the forms from 1995, but up to date there are no houses. But when you go to Extension 7, you find foreigners there, occupying the houses that were given by the government officials, and this is causing problems. That's one person from Hattie. Then I've got a female from Timbisa. Quote, South Africans are the problem. They get houses and rent them out to foreigners. They even sell them to foreigners. That's from Timbisa. Mamelodi. Quote, it is because the houses are not apportioned legally. People fork out money to get them. I heard that there is a housing department official who sells them for R1,000. And a couple more quotes. Tembisa, quote, what I have seen is that foreigners are many in this country, and they have access to houses, yet we South Africans have been waiting for them for years. That's a man in Tembisa. Another one, a person in Tembisa, quote, we are not disputing that during our struggle, our cadres stayed in their country, but they stayed in designated camps. They were not scattered all over Zimbabwe running spaza shops or having access to RDP houses. That's from Tembisa. And the last one, also from Tembisa, quote, government caused this whole thing because we South Africans wait for RDP houses, but foreigners don't, because they give government officials money. Now, Tembisa. And those were just a very few examples of. I think you know better than I do what some of these issues are. But it was very clear to us that people were not involved in housing. This is a major factor. So was housing a factor in the violence? Yes, absolutely. The common perception in all three areas, Mamelodi, Alex, and Tembisa, is that housing issues are a critical trigger of the frustration and the important element in the violence that took place in our country. The violence has most often been directed at foreigners, so I'll talk about that in 1 minute, and usually African immigrants in those areas. And then just a quote from this report, and you'll find some of what I'm talking about here, that I've tried to, in this presentation, not to rehash what you've got in front of you, but just give you some other information, because you can quite easily access the report. But between pages 22 and 23, there's a section on housing. And the quote from the report says, one of the most consistent areas of friction relates to the access to low-cost housing and to the dynamics that are unfolding in relation to housing delivery. So it's an undeniable element, and quite a few of the media reports about the launch of this report were very much concerned with the housing issue. Now, while housing is often important and a common source of tension, but it's not fair to say that it's the only trigger. Clearly there are a whole range of other issues that came up in our research that were extremely important. And one of the most important is that local areas are, of course, different. Where housing might be an issue in one area, it may not be in another. Or it may be a particular aspect of housing which is causing tension as opposed to something else. And we found that the violence where it took place was very localized and was very specific on the factors that were happening in that particular area. I mentioned gender, for instance, being a particular issue. And it was very clear that men and women, both immigrants and South Africans, had very different ideas about the role of foreigners in South Africa, about their lifestyles, about their access to resources, about their willingness to do work, and so on. And in fact, we I think, it was a common understanding of the workshop and of the HSRC team that xenophobia was a very inexact phrase for what happened. Now, this was not just against foreigners in the country. There were many examples of South Africans being targeted who were attacked or even killed. There were people who often spoke different languages depending on where they were living in the country at the time. They were South Africans, for example, from the Eastern Cape, who were new arrivals as opposed to older arrivals, but still South Africans. There were Pakistanis who were targeted in the violence. There were Chinese who were targeted in the violence. And there were African migrants from neighboring and SADC countries and from further afield who are also victims, including the Somalis. So it's we call it xenophobic violence. It's a very inexact, broad phrase. There's probably better words to be using, for instance, othering, the othering that takes place in communities. Who is the other? Who are the older locals? Who are the new arrivals? And how is that tension arising? And this is something that universities and research are grappling with at the moment, trying to understand where all the tension has come from. And of course, there are other very many important triggers of the violence, service delivery, not just housing. You know that there have been, I don't know how many hundreds protests against service delivery across the country in the last year or two, 800 or 900, I saw recently. People are unhappy about levels of service delivery. I'm sure you know about that better than I do. Unemployment, we're in a very tough economic condition and circumstances, not just in South Africa, but globally. And I'll give you a few figures to do with that in a minute. The economy is doing okay, but we're definitely going through a bit of a hard patch. Food is expensive. Fuel, at the time of the violence, has gone up incredibly high. Remember, it was up to $100 a barrel of fuel at that time, and it was incredibly expensive. And of course, those factors start to impact on our most vulnerable communities, and those largely are the people living in the informal areas. New arrivals, people on the periphery, trying to find work, trying to survive, and who are easily and directly affected by shortages of jobs, shortages of food, shortages of access to housing, to partners, and so on. So these are all factors. So I just want to emphasize that it's not just housing. You know, so as important as housing was, it forms part of a bigger picture, and it's only fair to think of it in broad terms. Some recent data about poverty, I just thought I'd explain to you to illustrate the fact that this is a problem that's going to get more intense and worse over the next 2 years. It's not just going to go away. I'm just going to give you some of the data that will suggest that. Remember that most of this violence took place in the urban periphery, so not necessarily in the rural, but mainly around the city, the violence took place, okay? In the informal areas. The HFRC brought out a book last year, in 2006, called Poverty and Policy in South Africa, and this comes, the data that I'm going to mention are coming from there, so if you want to access that, then you'll find that on our website. Poverty is increasing, and especially in urban areas, which we know. And has been doing so since 1994. The rural poor decreased from 62% of the poor were rural in 1996, from 62 to 56% in 2001. So gradually the proportion of people who are poor is increasing in the urban areas and decreasing in the rural areas. And that's another thing that we know. There's also a process of rapid urbanization from the richer provinces, from the poorer provinces to the richer ones. So there's a sort of migration which is adding to that process as well, and obviously putting pressure on housing and on services and on education. Unemployment is increasing. Whichever data you use, whichever measurement you use to measure that, and there's full inflation and partial inflation and so on, employment and so on, whichever one you use is increasing. Estimated that even as far ago as 2002, 8 million South Africans were without food. 8 million. And that's been increasing. I assume that that's gone up quite considerably in the last 6 years. That's a lot of people without income. And one last sort of data on the poverty issue is that in 1993, of the households that were just above the poverty line, just hanging in there, earning enough to beat that, $2 or $3 US dollars a day and surviving. 50% of those households are poorer now in poverty. So there's a great increase in poverty in the country, and this of course puts pressure on services and housing and so on. And it might help to explain why, when we get to it later, why South Africans who are finally getting their houses are a survival mechanism or rent them out again to South Africans with the foreigners to earn the money to live to stay alive and to feed their family. I don't think it's an unusual phenomenon. So So those are some of the sort of poverty related issues which are not going to make this problem go away, the xenophobia and this violence problem. It's something we were worried about in the report, and I've said many times, is that nothing has changed since May and now. The same factors are there, and in fact, if anything, they were. Sobering. Okay. On to the findings and recommendations of the report. We found, in sort of broad terms, and this we will find reference to in the report, there are three elements to the crisis. And one is a sort of short term, what we can do about it, there's a medium term, and there's a longer term. And those are all issues that need to be tackled. The first issue is we call it an implicit element. And that is really, it's a longer term issue. It's people's attitudes, it's people's culture. Two foreigners being in the country, two the distribution of resources. If you look, there's a table here, for example, this report, which tracks the xenophobic sentiments of South Africans. You won't be able to see it. It's on page 13. There's a little table here. Because it's so small and not in color, it's not as dramatic as it is, but we put it up on a PowerPoint. But basically it says that if you look in the informal urban areas, the perceptions of negative perceptions of South Africans towards foreigners is a chart that goes like that. People, every year, more and more people are getting angrier and angrier with foreigners being in South Africa. So that is one of the underlying triggers, if you like, the violence. But it's a very long-term aspect. You can't change perceptions overnight. And there are issues of culture and so on, which are also important. So there's a long-term change that needs to be made if we're really going to go on top of the xenophobia, on top of the violence. Then there's what we call conducive circumstances, which is often locally specific issues, like housing, like student delivery, like unemployment, like whatever local issues are really irritating people and making them angry. And those are sort of medium term. I mean, it's hard for anybody to do anything quickly about unemployment. But in local areas, things can be done, programs can be implemented, initiatives can be started. It's not impossible, particularly in areas where there's been violence for unemployment issues and service delivery issues to be tackled. And finally, what we call the triggers for violence. And that was what really made people get up and pick up a hunger and kill their neighbour. And it's hard to know what exactly those were. Part because it's human nature, it's a combination of all of these things. Local issues have come up. So we've got a sort of short-term, medium-term, and a longer-term attitude to how we sort of deal with some of these issues. As far as the non-housing recommendations go, I thought I'd just mention a few of them before we get on to the housing ones in particular. Because they all affect housing in one way or another, actually. They all have some interrelationship with housing type issues in one way or another. The first one was something that we called for in our first report. The 50 stakeholders called again for in the second report. And it's really the need for a national visa on xenophobia. Because it was really felt by everybody that the political leadership of the country needs to stand up much more publicly and say the xenophobia thing is nonsense. We need foreigners in the country to bring their skills and to help us build our economy. And we encourage local communities and local forums to get together to include foreigners and to plan and to build their communities together. And that really needs to start at the top and filter down. Secondly, we found that in many of the problem areas of communication was a real problem and had a lot to do with the frustration. Now, people often know that things, for instance, we'll come back to this, that housing is short in the country. They know that. But is there someone there who's able to tell them exactly where they are on the list, when they're going to be getting a house, and why it is that people seem to have leapfrogged about this? As an example, there have been 800 odd protests against service delivery in the country in the last year, and can't help feeling that much of that is just because government is not communicating effectively with students. There's no one there to talk to. There's no one to listen to people, to hear them, and to say, look, I'm sorry, it's a problem. We're doing our best. You know, you're number 373 on the list. Come back in a week or a month and we'll tell you how you're going. There's no one who's communicating. Communities are not feeling that there's someone they can go and talk to from government who can tell them what's happening. This is from the evidence of the focus and also from the stakeholders check as well. And also, and it's not just government to communities either, it's different tiers of government, provincial government, national government, local government. They're often not communicating particularly well with each other. Structures linked to government, such as the police or the courts, it's not good communication there either. And even within communities, there's poor communication. Between the communities and their structures, in many areas these structures are collapsed together, and some they're not very well maintained, and others they're very efficient. One of the pieces of evidence that we came across is that the better organized and structured community structures are, the less likely there is to be violence and xenophobia. We found that by doing a study in Izamuyetu near Harbay, which is one of the areas of the country which has huge potential for violence, because there are many foreigners living in that area, but nothing happens. Nothing happens because the community acted. They thought there was going to be a problem. They reached out to foreigners and to foreign people living in the area, and even though the police asked all the foreigners to leave, they were invited back in again by the community, and there's not been a problem there since May this year. So communication. Within communities, between communities and so-called other groups like foreigners, between governments and between government communities. A whole series of communication issues. Now, at the World Bank conference in Rome in 2006 on communication with developers, a document was issued called the Rome Consensus. And that was predicated on the fact that an estimated 95% of development projects in the world fail because communication breaks down. So it's increasingly been acknowledged as a key component to managing development issues to improve communication. Right. The third issue that we came across about recommendations is we found that people who are illegal, who don't have papers, who come into the country, who visas have expired, or whatever, that the illegals have been made very vulnerable in this country because they've got no alternative. They can't go to the police because they're illegal. They can't go to home affairs because they're illegal. And what that means is that they've been exploited. And they've been exploited by criminals. They've been exploited by employers who have paid them much too little and forced them to work long hours for nothing. And they've also been exploited by their neighbors and by their community. And there's nothing they can do about it because they're illegal. So one of our recommendations was to somehow find a way of conferring legality on people who are in the country. So we need to know who they are, we need to know where they are, because if we don't, we can't protect them. So that was one of the issues, but it may have implications on the argument. Two more. The fourth one is around recommendations, and that is that clearly socioeconomic rights and service delivery are usually important. Well, I think we all know that, and I won't dwell on that for very much longer. But, steps need to be taken to accelerate service delivery. It's a common understanding. I'm sure no one would disagree with that. And finally, this is to do with communication as well, is that the foreigners need to be involved in the structure. They need to be, often when they arrive in a country, these non-South Africans, they arrive with great skills. They're educated, they have access to resources, and they're more than willing to share those with South Africans if only we'd ask. So our recommendation included that we establish business enterprises and collaborations, arrange for the transfer of skills, and allow foreigners in the country to start giving to their communities, to build their communities, and to help them with computer skills and whatever other skills they bring to the country, to allow that exchange to take place. That will do a lot to reduce the tension. All right. Now, onto the housing issues in particular, and just a reminder that very few of the 50 stakeholders, and none of the community access institutions or community members who took part in the two studies that we've done are housing experts. So all I can really do is convey to you the problems that are raised. I can't offer you any solutions or answers that hopefully you will start thinking about. But as I mentioned earlier, and it says in both reports, over and over again, housing has been a part and a cause and a factor in the xenophobia and in the violence in our country, and especially the allocation of RDP housing. That we know. That is clear and crystal from the work that we've done over the last 7-8 months. Secondly, that there must be greater transparency in the system, even if the system itself is functioning in some cases better than others. If people don't understand what's happening, they're going to get frustrated, and if the frustration is allowed to be aggravated by other factors, it won't be long before a violent situation tensions start to arise. Communication is critical. There must be better communication around housing policy, around the allocation of housing, and around who get access to housing, who lives in housing, and who doesn't. Third, we talked about the need for a national audit of RDP housing. And to find out, and I know you've done some work in this area, I think engineering and the Cape Coast. As far as we understand, and we're not experts, as I said, we actually RDP housing. It wasn't clear to us from the preliminary work that we did, there were no data that we could find, so maybe you have some clues. Who's actually living in the house? Who isn't? Who's got leases? Who's renting from the South African leases and so on? So there just needs to be a lack of data around what exactly is the situation. And I think if something is causing such problems, you need to understand what the problem is. And also, we've put it down that there needs to be a new policy around the occupation of RDP houses. Now, there may be policy that exists. But certainly from everyone involved in this study, there was a sense that if there is policy not working, if there's new policy coming, then that's great, but the question of who gets that housing, under what conditions, needs to be addressed. And in fact, there were calls within the work which said that only South Africans should be occupying RDP housing, that foreigners should not be allowed to occupy state-subsidized housing. Directed towards the commercial market. Now, that's not necessarily the consensual position. It came up in the course of the research. It may not be the best sort of idea, but it was one of the suggestions that arose. It may be hard to reverse situations that are widespread without adding to the tension as well. But in any case, around the idea of the occupation of RDP housing, it's a huge issue. Okay, the last slide is on the way forward. I'm probably going to plug up my PowerPoint and I'll finish off and put up my thank you slide. The way forward, the HSRC is not, we're not a policy making institution. We do research. We can, if you commission or ask us to provide data or work, we can do that. But we don't design policy or make something that's new for others. The work so far has uncovered the perceptions of community and the common understanding of stakeholders. It's all been done quite quickly. It's only happened in May. We're now sitting in November. Even for us, that's fast. We've done two reports and to gather so much data and to engage with so many different communities and stakeholders. So while the work around xenophobia has been going along in universities for a decade or more, this is quite quick, often superficial work to give us an idea of what the issues are. So obviously more work needs to be done. The last few, I mentioned only a few of us are housing experts, and these recommendations often raise more questions than answers. It certainly suggests the need for a long, hard look at housing policy, particularly the allocation of RDP houses, And finally, that the HSRC could help. We are available, but it's up to you to what role you would like us to be the department. And that's all. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Joe, for that invitation. It's a mouthful. Members of the working for us, unless the other person wants to add anything, you wait until the person is fine. So, can you engage with the gentleman members? I have a member there.
Research Council. The first question I'd like to ask is that there was actually a parliamentary task you put together that went around a number of affected areas in the country and has done a lot of work with the Human Rights Commission and been involved in other fora as well. There was a report that was put together by that task team and published in the ACC Parliament, adopted by Parliament, there was debate as well. I'd like to know whether this document has actually found its way to that task team. And the leader of that task team was House Chairperson Obed Pella, who happens to come from the Alex area as well. So I'm just wanting to first find out whether this was actually presented to them, whether you yourselves have read the report of the task team, Parliament. That would be my first question. My second area really is that, if I can be very honest, I find your presentation here extremely negative. I don't get much positive out of it. And it's pretty much my interpretation is that it's just doom and gloom. And I don't think that's the case. That'll just be a comment. But in terms of recommendations, I was hoping that if I read your recommendations here, not much really is recommending. And I was expecting that when you were talking about recommendations now, that you were going to have to come up with some specifics. For instance, in your report, it talks about the fact that South Africans and people who have been beneficiaries of government housing programs sell their houses. We're well aware of that. And we know that. But in the view of the Human Rights Research Council, what would be a recommendation from yourself as to how one would actually stop that from happening? How one would actually ensure that on a regular basis, one is that, for instance, at the moment we have a 5-year moratorium on selling the house. Okay. So how would yourselves recommend that during those 5 years, what mechanisms need to be put in place to actually stop those houses from being sold? That's what I was hoping, that it would come from yourself, and actually real concrete recommendations and proposals that perhaps the department would be able to say, yeah, okay, that's something that could work. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to pick up on the last point that you mentioned, I feel slightly different. I think what the Research Council has done is it has pointed out some of the perceptions. Some of them may very well be real issues out there. But I was hoping that certainly I think that the various departments within government must have gotten hold of this report. It was tabled in cabinet. So I was actually hoping that the department, for example, when you look at housing, would come forward with some recommendations to address those perceptions, even if they are just perceptions, particularly with regard to the transparency and the allocation of housing. Having said that, Chairperson, I am again somewhat concerned, and perhaps a little bit gloomier than Greg is, because it's clear from the report, and I think we all know, that a lot of these issues have been simmering for years before there was actually this outbreak of virus. And yet, and I'm speaking collectively, I think we tended to sort of put our head in the sand. We were aware of this tension. And what is disturbing is that they seem to increase over the years. There's not that feeling, and I can almost guarantee you, if one has to do similar research now, that the feeling towards foreigners would probably be worse than what it was earlier this year. And there doesn't seem to be anything concrete. factors that we as a society is doing. One of the things that somewhere in this report, I've read it very briefly because I got it yesterday, was something about educating. In fact, I found it on page 25. And it says something about until communities have satisfied themselves, their grievances have been addressed. Now that's a very tall order. Because it's our responsibility to convey to these communities in terms of their grievances that they have been addressed, and it's not something that's going to be done overnight. So while I'm putting this comment on the table, I'm well aware, Chairperson, that I'm not really offering any concrete solutions as well. It's going to take, I think, something more than just a committee like we're having here. But it is a concern. We're heading into an election. Things do tend to get heated up as well. And there is definitely not only a perception, I think, but the belief from the community when it comes to housing, that they tend to take, for whatever reason, whether it's corruption or not, tend to take a bit of a backseat. And it can just take one person to have evidence of that. If they're on a waiting list and somebody else that's not on a waiting list, maybe a foreigner has happened to have been allocated a house, to spark off something like that. And I think really the department are well aware of the issues. It's not just since the violence started. These issues have been raised certainly in the 5 years that I've been in this committee just about. And they should come up with concrete solutions, housing solutions, to address exactly this perception. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
If
I can just want to say something or ask some questions to the council.
I don't really think housing was an issue that you should connect it to xenophobia. Yes, it did appear once in the area that you indicated as that parliamentary term. It only appeared in Alexander Township. And we did that day, those 2 days, we did a lot of areas. And fortunately, even in Alex, there was somebody who was responsible for housing. I don't know who it was, but there was somebody who corrected it. And clear it to people that it is not housing that people are fighting for it. I don't think housing is an issue in this area. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I can ask my colleague to talk about the parliamentary presentation and that conference.
I presented the findings of the report to the
parliamentary
report. And I can say what happened after that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
One of my colleagues. And in fact, we've engaged with many of the other government departments as well. The Cabinet, I mentioned, Home Affairs and Visa. The roundtable had members from the Presidency and from other departments present as well. So this is, we've been very much, we were aware of the parliamentary task team, and we've been involved in national discussions around these issues. Negative or positive? Well, we're not there to put a rosy light on what we found. We're just really presenting two bodies of evidence. One is what people were saying in a few days after the violence, and the other thing is what the experts were saying, or at least what the stakeholders were saying, and that included community workers, it included churches, government departments, universities. We're really just the messenger in a way for what people are saying about what happened around the issue. Around the sort of recommendations, I was anxious that when that my presentation today here would be unsatisfying for you in terms of specific recommendations around housing, because that's not what we were tasked to do. The housing issue came up because in the report and in the research, because it just kept coming up. We have not been specifically tasked to look at housing. We could do, if you wanted, we could bore right down into that and put a team onto specific recommendations around occupation and around housing policy, but that is not what the situation is. The situation is that we launched this research because there was a crisis in the country, and the housing kept coming up. That's why I'm here, and that's why it's not really dealt with in any great detail in the report. That's just the nature of it. But we'd be happy to do that if you wanted. And we wouldn't be the first sector or department who had asked us to do that sort of work. Education, the member was talking about, that's important, yes. Some of these things are longer term and some are shorter term. And some of the recommendations we included were that the school curriculum needs to be adjusted so that young South Africans and are more familiar with the importance and the role of foreigners in our economy and in our country. Another suggestion was that we have more festivals, so that, for instance, people from Congo or Somali can put their food out and play their music and dance their dances and encourage people to understand and appreciate their culture. And I think there seems to be quite a lot of support for that. The Honourable Member on housing not being an issue. As I said, that local areas were quite often different. They weren't all the same. They weren't all affected by the same factors. But the evidence that we came across, Honourable Member and Chair, through you, is that the 36 focus groups that we did in four different areas that were directly affected by the violence, the housing came up over and over again. Mm-hmm. So that was
Mama?
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to second Corinne Gray about the violence. You know, Chair, you are born in the Corinne Gray. You know, that was a black to black violence. I'm saying this because living in Johannesburg, they didn't go in here. The people who don't believe in Jesus. They kill even their neighbors, even in Johannesburg. So that it shows that it's a black to black violence, which we are used of. We are used of black to black violence. You know, 85 years in South Africa, there were a black to black. The people cross the hospital in Port Elizabeth, who we knew their home. But they came and burned our houses, killing our children. You know. And now the thing of houses, there is really a problem to the houses. But it's not because of the people who come abroad or the people of South Africa. It's the councillors. You know, in DE, my own cousin, he went for the houses. He went and they took his name and everything. And then he got the house. When he go now, when he get the keys, went to the house. That house was belonged to somebody else who was inside the house already. When he went to the, it was not him alone, in Port Elizabeth. He went straight to Masvalati to say, I've got this problem. After 6 months, when I said, go now and tell them you're going for the last, because we must take this thing up, they were saying, no, he was not approved by the provincial, you know, legislator. He was not approved, but the name is there, the keys of the house is there, the house is there, not for him alone. But now I think if maybe it can be something done to the councillors not to be arrested, to be trained, what are they there for, you know, because it didn't happen just for that, not to that area, to some other areas, even now it's happening. If you report this matter, no one care about it. Thank you.
Yes.
good morning once again. From the Department of Housing, we are currently responding to the report as presented. It will seem to us that the report requires a very comprehensive assessment, and I also feel that it needed to have assessed the issue more comprehensively instead of reacting to events and have at least 36 hearings across the country and put together a report in 2 weeks. To me, it's sort of sounding a little bit superficial and rather generalistic to say. But it is just not sufficient on the basis of what the report has to begin to make any assertions about the linkages between xenophobia and housing. Particularly when there is a confession that a few of your experts at the HSRC know very little about housing. And I also see some of the references you make throughout the text, which sort of show the degree to which there is not sufficient knowledge about housing policies and housing development over a period of time. I thought the focus may have been on poverty in general. And I see some references that are made on relative deprivation, for instance. I think on page 14. And I'm delighted to see my own name quoted there. And it's a piece that I wrote in 99, some time ago. And it was a piece written in response to the xenophobic violence that was taking place, or that took place the year before, which was 98. But what I find interesting about the quotation here, it's sort of, you also took it out of context a bit, and I don't think you read carefully towards the end, because I make a very solid argument about housing even then, which is contrary to what is presented here. But more importantly, if we look at what you said, if you said that there were 800 service delivery crushers in the last 2 or 3 years, what would be of interest is what would be the percentage of those interests, of those protests, which would have registered housing as a concern, and therefore you may then be in a position to make more useful deductions about housing. The victims, you said about 60 people were killed, and a third of those are South African. And a third of 60 will be, in simple arithmetic, it should be about 20. So that sort of it reduces the value of your argument even further. But more importantly, I think it's easy to find a convenient argument to say housing, because housing is visible. You go to a place, you see a house, you see a door, you see a roof, and somebody lives in there. Whereas social development is not visible. You can't see social development, whereas the Department of Social Development is doing just as much work. But because housing is practical, it's easier to sort of shift the blame on it. But even on that note, we investigated this with the Gauteng Provincial Department. And we established that at least 9 foreign in inverted commas, because either somebody is married to a South African who happens to have qualified for a house, and therefore that person who may be considered foreign in inverted commas lives there. So a total of 9 people or 9 persons were beneficiaries of housing in Gauteng. And if you look at the overall output of housing delivery in Gauteng, I think they are producing 60% of the overall total of our output per annum, which is about, say, 270,000. Gauteng will be building about, it should be about 70,000 houses. So even if you were to look at that in one financial year, to really single out 9 houses that may have been occupied because there was a slip in the system, even if we assume that, it's not really a fair representation of the facts. And if you put it in totality, out of, say, 10 million beneficiaries of houses nationally since 94, to single out that 9 out of 10 million may not be very representative statistically. And your recommendations, I think that sort of deductions are made, which are not based on any substantive analysis of the facts. And I don't know, it also makes some references to some very old documents, but I really would want to focus attention on page 39 particularly, where there are some suggestions there, which I don't know how they sort of come into the picture. If you look at the left-hand column, on the third paragraph, the one that says on the housing front. But that's not the point. The point is the last sentence there. It says what we need is an intervention strategy that develops alternative means of survival rather than providing houses. I don't know what that means, but sort of it may have other connotations. I think on page 40 or so, you make references to the Aliens Act. I think you were trying to make linkages between immigration policies and the presence of foreigners in the country. My understanding was that the Aliens Act came, you know, it ceased to be our official piece of legislation guiding migration sometime in the last 4 or 5 years or so. We now have an Immigration Act. So it sort of tells me that, you know, the piece was sort of hurriedly put together and it will require a very substantive analysis. And I think some of the references you made, particularly studies that were done by the Southern African Migration Project, were far more comprehensive and they may still inform some of your analysis.
When we initially got the report and read it, I think it tried to get to what it posed as a problem. I think this presentation, unfortunately, kind of gets to a point, kind of conceptually, where it says if the solution is a hammer, then all problems are nails. So you kind of narrowed it down to, well, you got to solve housing and then you'll solve xenophobic problems. And I think that's where it begins to kind of come apart a little bit. So I think the report had, you know, it was perception that told us things, it was useful, it was immediate, there was an immediacy that was great. And I think now that we have moments to reflect on it, and I think my colleagues pointing to it, I think it has to be much more substantive. And I think the perceptions have to give way to much more substantive research. Otherwise, I think quite correctly pointed out earlier by members of this committee, you will become the vehicle of perpetuating myths, and then it gets quoted out of context. But let's take that as it may. Maybe some things. I think your starting point, so some conceptual questions, and you may have to look at that and come back, and I think there's value in each one of these, and you've got to use a cross-comparison. Migrants in formal settlement reception areas. Migrants also come to other reception areas. Reception areas is a useful word. Mark Napier's recent work on urban land markets suggests that most people wait in informal settlements as a waiting mechanism, and a lot of communication occurs through it. So dispelling also your annexure that government is mistrusted. Quite on the contrary, government's an important communicator, and informal settlements are usually that. There's usually, and I'll come back to it later, a correlation between informal settlements and substantive communities and the relationship between them. So the notion of hosts do exist, even for non-nationals. So that's not true, and I contest that. And that's a lot of literature in South Africa suggesting that otherwise. And other reception areas, is Helbau a reception area, and what kind of violence occurred there, and what were the limits on it, and who lives there? So I'm not sure you correlate it in that way, but later we come back to
typology and your description on what happened on the urban edge, my interpretation is most of the informal settlements you spoke to are not on the urban edge and are dislocated from host communities. And I don't see any literature or any suggestions about the distinction or about the geographies of violence. So, but we can come back to that. I think that the first thing is the perception is maybe be careful that we don't perpetuate that and what that may mean against reality. Secondly, it is about quotes, but it is about violence, and you do talk about triggers. And not in that moment is housing the trigger. I think that you say in the discussion, it becomes a point of anger and resentment and easy to point to. But I think later in your discussions, the triggers are different things, and they're much more complex than that. So that also then says, therefore, what for housing, and your recommendations are somewhat thin on housing. So that's a problem. I think my colleague here said that, and I think your description of othering is much more useful. I think in the history here, other can also mean the wrong end of town, and we know that too. And there's a whole history of studies around that kind of materials, and the U.S. is rich in that kind of notion of other. A more successful version of that, which I thought you might use, I mean, Britain is great, but Canada is a great version of how to deal with other and mechanisms around that, and there's no reference to that. What you do point to is the relationship between the study and violence, and that's more significant, and we thought that your point around violence was more important. Okay, so it was just about vulnerability and violence. There is a literature on the urbanization of poverty, which is perhaps better than using the literature that's suggested in your annexure. I think the annexure could be looked at differently, and the use of that as a knowledge source to define that is nice for some things, but for identity stuff, but I'm not sure for xenophobic violence. So the discourses can be different. The questions of inclusion, informal settlements, we don't know the geographies of those, but we perceived in earlier versions that those geographies are quite significant. Where's the geography and where's the violence? Ekurhuleni are all dislocated from existing townships, therefore there's no host community. Does that propel violence if there's no community moderating it, no NGOs present, etc.? Poverty is complex, and it's human resource, access poverty, and income poverty, and all three are playing themselves out here. We don't have jobs, human resource skills. We take an asset because government gives it to us, but to get income poverty resolved, we sublet it. It's logical. It's called the market. Is that wrong? I think that we got to deal with that very progressively, and the housing DNG is very clear about that. I don't want to go into the questions of complexities of identity. I think that's a new literature, very interesting, but I think it's less significant here. What are the things that governments must do well to get it right? So I think, the concluding note on that is maybe they have said, but we have thought about much more closer correlations between xenophobic violence and recommendations, and they're not present here, and we could have a discussion outside of that as housing officials. We think that they're absent, but they are very specific ones, and we could talk to them. For example, in the IDP process and in the housing chapters, should there be a greater engagement? Should municipalities be the front end of this? And is the condition, most importantly, that you're raising a housing condition or human settlement management condition, which is the problem is not housing, the problem is managing of settlement.
Chair, I think the gentleman is thinking one of my ideas. But let me emphasize that the housing problems have been there since, you know, donkey years and during the apartheid era. And foreigners are not new in South Africa. They have not only arrived in 1990. I shouldn't see an emphasis on housing as the main character which caused. And the other factor is, I haven't got through it, unfortunately. I didn't hear you maybe mentioning the issue of intelligence. Have you spoken to the National Intelligence Council to find out possibilities of a task force as well? You know, we are a new democracy, and obviously, in that sense, there's going to be, you know, some forces, you know, which would destabilize our democracy. We didn't hear you mention that. It is a possibility. You know, there should be other underlying causes. Because this violence only started here, and we've been saying it for many years. And I believe that it's not only these vectors that are mentioned here. Maybe your analysis would give us a better picture and your other causes.
Thanks, Chair. I think we could talk for 6 months on just half a dozen of those issues. And I do thank my colleagues from the department. That was valuable and generally speaking, quite correct. But there is a need for much more substantive work. But I did emphasise that we did not come at this from a specialization in housing, but really from the fact that it was just raised so often by so many people as being a critical factor. And I agree that much more substantive work is necessary to prove the linkages, to investigate definitions of the geography of violence and so on. I think those are all very valuable points. Chair, I don't really know where to start. Let me start at the end and go backwards. With the third, fourth question, because that I am comfortable answering, and again, in relation to our research, which was quick and limited, so for what it's worth. But having said that, we did have government involved in this work, including a big contingent from the Alexandra Police Station, who were part of the round table. And nowhere did we come across the idea of a third force being a factor in this at all, not on one single occasion during the research or the discussion. Was that a factor? But it doesn't mean it wasn't one, but we'd had no experience of that being reported on or suggested by 50 stakeholders and several hundred focus group members. Maybe that's something that needs to be looked at more specifically. We did not have an engagement with the intelligence community about this. Going back, it would be interesting to know the percentage of protests that were on housing. That's absolutely correct. I didn't say we don't have housing experts at the HSRC. I said we didn't have housing experts at the Moxie and governance who are working on this project. But there are people who do work in this area. Perhaps if we were to look at doing a new and more substantive work, that we would bring in the people to engage with it. Otherwise, Chair, I think I'm going to, unless my colleague over there wants to say something, I mean, I said we could talk about this for 6 months, but I would agree that in general, this was rapidly at the request of government. We wanted to know what was happening, and we have tried to answer that as best as we were able to, but clearly there's a need for more substantive work in the area. I'll ask my colleague to respond to the end.
Sure. Thank you, Chair. I must say, as somebody who works in a university environment, I'm very encouraged by the kind of interrogation, scholarly reading of the text that I've done and the questions that were asked, and they're all actually incredibly
useful.
Could go
close to the mic, too, and hear you.
I think, as Adrian said from the outset, you probably generated more questions out of this report than answered them, and that partly was an important thing, I think, because one of the things we did want to get clarity on was before we talk about solutions, what are the problems, what are the questions and the challenge that you have to address, and of course they're incredibly complex if you look at them from a range of different angles, and it can give you the perception sometimes of being overwhelmed. So for example, you know, the fact that South Africa is not an island, and we can't imagine that people are not going to continuously migrate to South Africa. It's going to become a hub like on the continent you have in Egypt and you have in West Africa, Southern Africa. There are certain hub economies that attack people. There's constant migration from elsewhere. That's going to be something we're going to have to look at, and I think has longer term implications for how we think about citizenship, for example, and how we think about rights. Who has access to the rights and benefits of citizenship? Who has access to the goods of the state, who has access to things like housing. These are very real and complex issues that do impact on housing, for example. So that's a bigger question. But they can be looked at in more specific and one of the I think research areas that we're quite keen on looking at, for example, is how do you think about government communication? There's quite clearly a difference between perception and reality. And the reality that we might describe empirically, the number of people who actually occupy houses, can be quite different to the perception that's out there. And perception can undermine a good plan and a good policy, you know, and so to connect the two and to break the disjuncture between the perception and reality requires communication mechanisms. What would be the kind of communication mechanism that work in a developmental context? That would be one of the research areas that we, for example, would be interested in looking at. But the other would be to look at the way in which policies have to be implemented and can have unintended consequences or deal with an environment, for example, the environment of poverty and the environment of the casualization of labor, which means people do turn their houses into assets that can be transferred to cash. How do you deal with that at a very local level? That requires a certain kind of long-term ethnographic local studies and perhaps piloting of projects and studying what happens when you implement a policy in one particular area and what are the unintended consequences that undermine that policy when you roll it out at a national level. So these are, again, questions and research areas that just emerge from these kind of studies.
Members, thank you very much. I think there is an emerging consensus from the discussion, and I'm very happy with your response. That says that, yes, there is this report written by the agents of state. It really opened up this question about the policy in terms of the housing policy itself. And there's a robust argument from the department side and from the members. And perhaps says that the period that has been done in coming up to that conclusion is under question. Of course, it was important for agencies to respond at that time because the government wanted to know what is happening. But I think we should take this report as a starting point of saying, we cannot discuss everything, that more work needs to be done. And we cannot undermine the fact that one of the things that has been raised is that housing allocation. We all know, we agree as members, that there is a question mark in terms of the issue of the housing allocation. And this department has been grappling with that. But we know. What does the committee know? Ourselves. But we don't want a situation that says that xenophobic attacks have been triggered by housing policy. That is what we disagree with. So at this point in time, we say that is not correct. We are saying there are loopholes in terms of the housing policy that needs to be dealt with. One element of it is an administrative, housing allocation, that's an administrative issue. It's an implementation issue, and that should be dealt with. And that should be looked at. You cannot ignore it is there. You have to look at it. But tell us what needs to be done in terms of finding exactly where we are in South Africa as far as housing is concerned. And perhaps this report, and together with critical analysis by the department in a written form, not in terms of what you've done. You've done it, do it in writing then. Because it will help us to have those kind of analysis and we understand the limitations of what we've come up with. And I think this is, to look at this in terms of work in progress, taking into account also the report that has been done by Parliament itself. Because Parliament is informing us better. So that report also needs to be dealt with when we do said analysis. Perhaps sometime next year, I think after elections, we need to look in terms of what is it that needs to be done to ensure we implement the proposal of the housing needs nationally to look at what is the situation around South Africa. But this particular one, please, the housing policy, this is things can disagree with me. That I was shocked really when I saw on TV they think that the housing policy is too bad to be violent or sexual. Because on its own, it says that whatever we have done in terms of housing at the moment has been right to talk about questionable area. Of course, allocation is a problem. Housing data we don't have. We're working on that. It's a work in progress. All these other elements. But you cannot say on the basis you do look on it yourself, on the basis of the limited observation that has been done. Therefore, we arrive at this point. I think it's pretty much it. You can say, I just don't these numbers. Because I think, let's say, we have a piece of work in front of us. Let's take it as a work in progress and move forward. So that the committee that is going to analysis from the department side in enhancing that and move on. But definitely, it's working progress. That I'm saying, the policy is questionable as such, but it's very premature to analyze that.
Thank you. Yes, you may actually be surprised to know that I do agree with you.
Okay.
I think that people in fact use,
yes,
after the event, use the excuse of housing,
yes,
to justify what they've done. And I personally don't think that is the critical or the main trigger. What I am disappointed in this particular session of our meeting is that, and as you mentioned, the allocation of RDP housing is and has been a problem, and we've all been aware of it. And rather than get some positive feedback from the department in terms of what they may be doing or looking into doing, they don't mention it at all. The transparency issue is and has been a problem. Anybody that has got an approval for the subsidy today, if they approach any provincial department or municipality, they are unable to tell them exactly when, where, if ever they'll be getting a house. Those are issues that we must address. And as the other gentleman said, it may be one perception, it may be one out of 1,000, but it is a perception and it does undermine the other good work that has been done. So those for me, and I'm concentrating on housing, is the issues that we should be looking at finding solutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Member. I want to thank you for your time and the work that you have done. And we think this is it's a work that needs to be looked at.
I just wanted to thank colleagues and members and the department for the opportunity, and to say that we're willing to engage and to do more work that you think necessary. We do work for you after all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Anything from the department side? Five? Well, all five. Let's go to the memorial service of Mama Miriam Mateva. We, as the Circular Committee of Housing, ensure that today we can take that moment to her. The memorial service is at all our services, so about half past 11. And hope all members will have a moment. You can say well to Mama after that, all our services are coming. Half past 11. No? They are not there yesterday. No, it's supposed
to be today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Fine. Study group.
What do you say about the study group? Come here, no. Tell everybody your name and talk about it. Yeah. That's pretty wonderful.
That's all the similar.
Yes. Thank you.